Subjects of love and beauty reflected on these two experiences of life, and also of these are common enough words they used in practically all pop songs, and can mean the most banal things or can be taken to a kind of a spiritual profundity. This is what the human mind can do. We can trivialize anything, making the most sacred, profound things into just trivia, or we can bring them to just through our own reflective capacity and intelligence. Realize what they actually are in terms of ultimate experience as a human individual. I think one thing that attracts many of us to Buddha Dhamma is that it does encourage us to contemplate and to look more deeply, and not just be caught up in the conditioning of the mind or the superficiality and artificialness of that we can kind of become or we can be addicted to. Because if we don't look into or try to understand things and get beyond just the superficial interpretations, then, or just see life only in terms of sentiments and ideals, then of course something in us is never fulfilled, and we merely live on the surface, the appearances. It's more like a cosmetic existence. A beauty is something that we can. In terms of Buddha Dhamma, we can see beauty as that which tempts and lures us. As we say, we can see it as temptation. That's one way of looking at it, of relating to what is beautiful. Something that will arouse desire, arouse greed, will make us want to grasp it, to have it for ourselves. So that's one way of relating to beauty, is by seeing it only in terms of it tantalizing or creating desire in our minds to possess what is beautiful. But that is, of course, just the surface of the mind, the conditioned mind that is that doesn't go very deep. It's what is quite natural in terms of reactiveness, because on the level of just reaction, beauty is the attractive force. So when we come across it through visual, through sight or sound, smell, taste or touch, or even thought itself, then we can easily just want more. We want to have it. We want to possess it. We want to grasp it. And then the opposite, say ugliness or repulsiveness, is of course the reaction to that is to destroy it, to get rid of it, to run away. But beauty is also a symbol for ultimate reality, and for it's a spiritual a reminder. When we live on this planet, we have. There's so many beautiful things on this planet that we see just on the level of vision. As on a summer's day in Amaravati, or in the various seasons of the year, just visual consciousness gives us many kind of beautiful sights that we perceive through our eyes. And then, of course, how we respond to that beauty can be just the reactive, addictive tendencies of the mind to just want to get it, to hold it, to capture it, to possess. But in, say, as we see the pain and the suffering that we create by the desire to grasp and hold the beautiful and to make it ours, we begin to stop. Or we no longer feel inclined to want to follow such tendencies or habits, emotional habits, but we're willing to let the beautiful be that. Just what it is, the experience of beauty in the moment, the as-isness, the suchness, and also the reminder, that which takes us to beyond just the beautiful form itself, but to see that which is beautiful as that which reminds us of the deathless, or the ultimate release from the changing conditions that we are so deluded by, so overwhelmed by our own bodies, by our own emotions, our own mental conditioning. Did you ever contemplate the miracle of your own mind, just the ability that each one of us can create concepts of ultimate perfect beauty? We can put a whole list of superlatives together and saying the ultimate, absolute, most perfect, beautiful thing. This this might sound like we're just playing games with our mind, but actually this leads us to say maybe an uplifting of the spirit, if we're not being cynical about it and not just doing it as a game, but as we allow our minds to say move toward the best or the ultimate, the most beautiful, perfect beauty. And then just the fact that we can imagine such a possibility. Or when we see something that is truly beautiful, how our emotional response to it, what is that like? How we can, if we can just accept it and appreciate it and be grateful for it. Or what do we usually do now? We want to take a picture of it. We immediately get out our camera and want to snap a picture, try to capture it on a film, and then the film comes out. It's only a kind of minor thing, even if it is a good photograph, because the desire to hold and to grasp is so strong that sometimes we don't allow ourselves just to accept the fleetingness of a beautiful moment and appreciate it in the fact that it is just that, and that there's no need to add to it or try to get anything out of it for ourselves or to keep anything of it. Not even have to remember it, because in its own right it is the reminder, that which tells us that the state, the ultimate reality, is truly beautiful. Or that this universe and this realm, this experience that we're all involved in, its true nature is beauty, is beautiful. And not just in terms of form or color, but its nature is such that we have the ability to perceive or to experience and objectify the beautiful. Now, the deluded mind is the mind that when it sees beauty, then it just reacts. A reaction, say, is different than a response. I use the word response as a skillful way of dealing with, say, such a thing as beauty or ugliness or right and wrong or pleasure and pain. They are, a response is done mindfully when we and it's done with awareness and with wisdom, where a reaction is merely like a condition, like the Pavlovian dog, with the habit tendencies. We can be merely reactive creatures, like the dog. We just get conditioned to salivate when the bell rings, even when there's when there's no food around, nothing to create salivation. We've become conditioned to do these kind of things out of context because this is a reaction that we've developed. So just to say the unreflective human being that just reacts to beauty tends to see it just merely as something you want to get. You see the flower, you pick it. You see a beautiful woman, you develop a fantasy life around her, or you want to touch her or grab her, or you see a beautiful sunset and you want to kind of, you feel a desire to hold on to it, to try to capture it. And I've noticed this, I used to notice a kind of painful feeling in my mind when I was looking at like beautiful scenery, because there was along with this the tendency to want to hold on to it in some way, even though you know it was impossible to do so. There's no way you can kind of hold on to scenery that you're passing through, but still there's this kind of desire, and this desire is kind of trying to keep it, trying to hold it, trying to get it, cling to it in some way. Which then, of course, it does. You can't do it, so you end up feeling exhausted, wondering why you came back from a sightseeing tour totally exhausted, because all the time you're looking at things, and some part of you is always trying to hold on or keep it, or afraid you were going to miss out on something. Couldn't get enough of it. I remember when I first went to Switzerland, they kept taking me on tours, sightseeing tours, and Switzerland's so beautiful. Everything you look at is beautiful, and you spend the day, they drive me around in a car, and be looking like this, and trying to hold on, keep everything in sight, afraid I might miss out on something, a quaint little chalet or a mountain peak, only to come back to my room totally exhausted. And thinking, I don't know why I go on these sightseeing trips. They're a pain. You come back tired. But as we begin to recognize the problem and the cause of suffering, then we can let go of that cause, and then beauty is what speaks to us in its profundity, and we can appreciate it without trying to possess. And its absence is now no longer something that we're going to be upset by the absence of beauty, because we're neither trying to hold it, keep it, make it permanent, nor are we always trying to find it and seek it again. Because as we learn to let go of the causes of suffering, then our mind is open to the flow of life, the way life actually is. So beauty and ugliness, say, teach us important lessons. Pleasure and pain, right and wrong, these dualisms, the extremities of the conditioned realm, can teach us about the way things are. And as we open our heart and our mind to receive these lessons, what's happened to my... There. That's... See, these are deliberately planned pauses.
We can concentrate on you.
Now you can you can stop contemplating my beauty for a moment. The other subject of love is a word that is very meaningful to us, isn't it? It's a word that inspires. And it's used for all kinds of things. And yet we can relate to it as something that is the greatest kind of human experience possible. We can see it in its function as unitive, that which unites, as non-discriminative, isn't it? Love, when there's love in the heart, then one isn't... caught up with clinging to views of critical views or negative states of mind. But it also has its most kind of silly interpretations. When we talk about loving fish and chips and love this and that and love Elvis Presley and or it can mean just a form of greed, just wanting something. So we can see it in its absolute form, or its universal, or its spiritual aspects. Now, the word itself probably has its roots in probably some form of word meaning greed. From what I've gleaned, it probably can, its original meaning was maybe more kind of wanting something or liking something. But as it's generally used in religious terminology, like when the Christians talk about Christian love, it isn't greed, is it? It's not. It's on the level of say what we would call metta or loving kindness, but because this function, this experience of love is what holds things together. It's the cohesive force in the universe. If there was no love in the universe, I think everything would fall apart. And then this is just a reflection. I'm not trying to prove this as a scientist, but just as the experience of life, say. When there is no love, when we do not feel love for anything, when our life is mainly based on fault-finding, criticisms, seeing what's wrong, obsession with negative things, then it's like we no longer we're no longer radiant beings. We get an ugly appearance. Our faces become ugly masks of criticism and distaste and disgust. And then that very appearance tends to create aversion in others, because that which is ugly and conveys negativity and disgust and aversion is makes us want to say not we were not attracted to it. We feel repelled by it. So someone who has a loving countenance is a very attractive person, a beautiful presence. We feel it is just the natural reaction to a loving heart is that we feel attracted to it. We want to go towards it. Then to someone who's filled with hatred and anger, we want to get away, run away, go the opposite direction. That's just the natural reaction to say beauty and ugliness, or love and hate. Love also means, its more banal meaning is around the seeing some, what we love we want to hold on to, we want to keep. So that comes from the desire mind, the sense of that if we feel this experience of love toward this particular person, then we think, we have the feeling that if we possess them, we own them, then we would have that experience all the time. Because they make us feel so happy now that if we could really hang on to them, we could feel happy all the time. But just that kind of thought alone destroys love, doesn't it? Just trying to hold on, keep, and possess something means that you no longer can enjoy even that which is... You once loved, because you're no longer allowing yourself to relate to it in the right way. So we have these, we've all had these experiences in our lives where we fall in love with somebody and then we try to possess them and they resist it, and then we're brokenhearted. Pop songs are all about that, isn't it? I think most of us have had that kind of suffering in our lives. Just the ignorance of youth when we're young, isn't it? We don't know any better. So when we feel this kind of attraction towards somebody, then we want to get hold of them, grasp them. We get jealous. We get possessive. And those kind of mental states, of course, make us no longer attractive to the other person. We become ugly and difficult and obnoxious. So the spiritual goal of love then is to free ourselves from these kind of reactions, negative, unwholesome reactions to that which is beautiful, so that our lives are not, say, we're not, we are learning from these experiences, and we can therefore say change our way of relating to the world, to the beings, to the things, to the bodies we have, to the experience of life. As we go along, we are willing to learn from our mistakes. And in order to do that, we need to know that we need to remind ourselves, to remember that love is something that we can't, it doesn't, it's not something that we can kind of make ourselves feel. It's when we really trust and open ourselves and recognize that the objects that we might love are merely remembrances or reminders of the ultimate experience, where we feel, say, love that is not personal anymore, not bound into the perceptions of self-interest or conditionality. As a Buddhist monk, it's interesting to see what is the love, the great love of a Buddhist monk. Is this a time for confessions? And the, say, from just the experience of this Buddhist monk sitting here, I would say for me, the love of my life has been the Dharma, and this has been more powerful than, say, any kind of attraction to any individual being or anything, earthly thing. But it's something that is cultivated too. It didn't just happen that way. It wasn't that I was born with this ability. But it is through the power of meditation and reflection that, and through the putting into practice the Buddhist teachings, that this kind of love developed. Or one can call it faith. It's a form of faith, but it is also a commitment. One wants, when you love something, then you commit yourself to it. You want to serve. You want to be the servant. It's interesting when one of the things that picture over here on the left of Buddhadasa, bhikkhu who died last year in Thailand. He called himself Buddhadasa, servant of the Buddha. And in Thailand, there was one American monk there that loved to translate it as slave of the Buddha. He said, Buddhadasa means, dasa is sometimes used for slave in Thai, or it can mean servant. And then here in England, sometimes people don't like to be considered a servant of anyone. Not to mention a slave. So we don't use the slave interpretation. They say, we are the slaves of the Buddha. It would sound sick in this. Servant is getting, people don't like to think of themselves as servants either. But I do. I like to, I think that's a position that I respect. To see, if I contemplate my position, I think of myself as a servant of the Buddha rather than, many Western Buddhists don't even want to be considered Buddhists. That we practice meditation, or we're meditators and we use Buddhist meditation techniques, but they don't feel any love maybe for the Buddha, or the Dhamma, or the Sangha. Also, this love can be realized towards an individual, such as the teacher, the Ajahn Chah, towards another human being. So, but this love was a love based on gratitude for the teaching, for the kindness, for the compassion that he showed me, while accepting me, recalcitrant, difficult American that I was, and having to put up with some of my ways and clumsiness for years, and so forth, and yet there was always this willingness to support, help, and encourage me. So when one looked back over the years, of living with such a teacher, then this sense of gratitude developed. Gratitude is a kind of love. It comes from the heart. But to develop this, one needs to remember the good things of one's life, the love of one's parents. When I think back of my, the good things that my parents have done for me, the kind of efforts they put into helping me and supporting me and taking care of me, loving me as a child, protecting me, then this feeling of gratitude arises. Thinking in terms of being a member of the Sangha or the Buddhist, those who practice the teachings of the Buddha, then one feels this love of all those people who have helped me over the years, the lay people who put food in the alms bowl, or the people that helped me to the civil servants in the Thai civil service that gave me residence visas and let me stay in the country and all the other generous acts and encouragement one received from various lay groups, lay people, or the members of the monastic sangha itself. So this is thinking in a positive way in terms of the beauty that one has experienced in life from other human beings, or from the Buddha, or by really noting the beauty that surrounds one in one's daily life. Now I noticed that the tendency of my mind was not to feel like this, but to be one who was more aware of what was wrong. I remember I used to wake up in the morning with this feeling of dread all the time. What's going to happen today? Meaning that I was expecting something bad might happen today. Or I think of difficulties that I might have to face, or decisions I might have to make, or scenes and situations that would put me on the spot or cause me some unpleasant feelings, and a feeling of just not wanting to participate in life sometimes. Remember, as a young person, wanting to find a way of life which I could avoid responsibility, and which these kind of experiences would be at the minimum, where I would not be in a place where I'd have to be making decisions, or say be put on the spot, or be in difficult scenes, or involved in complex ways with other people and situations. So there was, say, when I found myself in a situation where I was involved and had to come forth in various ways and take risks and make mistakes and be blamed and be involved in this human realm, this society, the mind I'd wake up in the morning and think, oh, another day, and sometimes it'd be kind of death wishes. Oh, I can hardly wait to die. When is this going to be over with? There's a kind of grumbling. Oh, another problem. Oh, here comes another one. Looking at people as just an endless series of problems. Seeing it only in terms of it's going to inconvenience me, or I'm going to be put on the spot, or I'm in a position where I could be blamed for something. One didn't want to be blamed or criticized. So noting these tendencies of these kind of emotional tendencies and this negativeness towards life, I realized that I didn't really notice the beauty of my life, because these negative reactions tended to dominate my conscious experience. They tend to kind of hang around you in your mind. They kind of go along with you. Wherever you go, they kind of accompany you. And you can even go on a holiday and take them on your holiday if you want. And it goes on and on like that. When say when one was a child, you didn't have that problem. You more with the things as they happen. You more happiness when there was happy conditions, and unhappiness when there was unhappy conditions. But there wasn't the sense the ego hadn't become kind of solidified and fixed and habituated towards, say, worry, anxiety, resentment. So then the practice of meditation was quite a revelation, because it says here and now, be with the present. And of course, at first this meant being with some of these negative states, because one was so easily producing these negative states that at first these negative states seemed to be what was present. And so you learned how to say, bear them, recognize them, but they are impermanent. And as we begin to let go of the causes that produce this negativity, then we are, say, aware of the beauty and the blessings that surround us. And I remember waking one morning in my kuti, meditation hut, and feeling, and this morning, particular morning, I had this, instead of being negative, or feeling, oh, not another day, I wonder what's going to happen today, kind of feeling, I woke up and I had a sense of like I was in like one of these space travelers. I could just kind of float in the air. There was this feeling of I could flop this way and I wouldn't hurt myself, or I could flop that way. That this whole kind of blessedness, sanctity was surrounding me, and then I could just kind of relax and just let go of everything, and whatever way I happened to fall, it would be all right. And I wouldn't be hurt. And this was such a pleasant to wake up and feel like this was quite wonderful, because usually waking up involved the other. So this was like a sign. One has these signs as one meditates of some kind of change that will take place or has taken place. And then, of course, more and more one became aware of things, just flashes of things, and just the way that the sunlight would fall. You didn't have to go to Switzerland and look at majestic mountain scenery or go to the Grand Canyon. I remember going once to the Grand Canyon. Somebody took me on an airplane flight through the Grand Canyon. Fantastic experience, going on this little airplane as it flew right into the canyon. You see all these magnificent colors and the kind of marvelous, majestic scenery of the Grand Canyon. But and so before, one would maybe go to want to see the beauty of some absolutely fantastic place, where the travel brochures, what they advise you to admire and see, and everybody says it's fantastic and marvelous. But after this experience, then one began to see that around one, not in terms of fantastic scenery, but the beauty that is surrounding us in ways that sometimes we aren't aware of or we don't notice, because of our tendency to be obsessed with the negative conditions. And so then because of this, the way of life or the movement of one's life was much more joyful, and one didn't feel a need to kind of go any place or do anything, because one's daily life was enough. There is enough blessedness and beauty and goodness in just daily life that it wasn't, one didn't feel a need to go and look for it in some other place or through some more extreme experience. But of course, the human condition tends to forget. This is where we develop means to keep remembering. That's why we keep saying, here and now, be mindful here and now. I think we get bored with this kind of advice, or we think of it as something somebody's just saying the same thing over and over again. But what we're really doing is reminding or remembering, because we forget. It's easy to fall right back into the old negative state. And especially when situations arise that are unpleasant. It's easy to just, when some unpleasant or unwanted situation arises, then of course it's easy to just go into worry and negativity and anxiety about it, because that is the how the mind is conditioned, generally, that has that tendency. That's what habit is. It's what we're used to. So this is where the faith in the Dhamma, the love of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the great love, is cultivated, is remembered, not cultivated as a kind of artificial thing, but a reminder of it. And willing to keep reminding yourself of it, to keep, say, bearing with and enduring the unpleasant experience of life, but letting it go, letting it be what it is, but allowing it to go, and to be able to fill the mind with beauty. Because we can create beauty in our mind. We can respond to the ugly, to the unpleasant, in a beautiful way. The mind, say, of a human being has this ability to create. It's a mind that can look at things from different angles. We can say that the results of good meditation practice is we find a very flexible mind. It's malleable. We're not kind of fixed. We're not holding on to one particular view, one position on life, one thing. And this is what I think people get confused when they talk about religion, because usually, what we perceive religion as being is a commitment to a particular viewpoint, a particular doctrine, a particular convention. So we do find that even though the say particular convention that we might favor is beautiful, we attach to the convention itself, and therefore sometimes, even though we're attached to a beautiful convention, we become quite ugly. Because we hate all the other conventions. So you hear people saying, you know, so-and-so is a Buddhist, and I always respected Buddhism, but, you know, now she's so bitter and so critical of everything else that... you know, I've lost all faith in Buddhism because she's been a Buddhist for years now, and look at her. Narrow-minded, bigoted, full of resentment and bitterness. I remember when I was president of the Buddhist Society, things that used to happen there, people would say, I didn't think Buddhists would act like this. Because we perceive a Buddhist as maybe a kind of Buddha, somebody who is absolutely perfect and never goes off the track. He's already there permanently, enlightened and doesn't have any bad habits to overwhelm them. But also, as Buddhists, we can get very attached to views and opinions about Buddhism or schools or sects or techniques. And this attachment, of course, is the problem, is where the suffering is. Because we might be attached to something very beautiful, but then, of course, what happens? We don't become beautiful. We can become prejudiced, biased, narrow-minded. Not because of the convention, but because of attachment to it. So this we need to contemplate and learn how to, say, not attach, but to be open to things, to be able to use a convention for reflection, for as a tool to reflect from, as a guide, as a remembrance, as a reminder, rather than as a position that one is taking and one is identified with. And this seems to me to be the challenge of our age, isn't it? Where humanity, this kind of mind is possible, but it's not highly developed yet in human beings in general. Generally, human beings are very fixed, very attached to political views or ethnic views or prejudices or opinions. And we can see that some of those opinions and views are maybe even quite good or right or beautiful, but still the attachment creates this ugliness, this pain, this dukkha, because when there's attachment, then the love is not possible. That love only operate through non-attachment. Because when there's attachment, then the love is gone, and therefore the beauty that we're attached to is corrupted, or we're corrupted by the attachment to it. So this is for contemplation and consideration for you. The love, say, in your life, and the beauty of your life. And not to see it in terms of a lack of it, but begin to, say, notice it more. Rather than think that there's something missing, or that you've got to find it. It's not a matter of finding it somewhere else, but in recognizing it, realizing it. One of the great obstructions, of course, is pride. And this is something we all have to deal with, is pride and conceit. So that this also, this is an attachment, a view of ourselves, a kind of wanting to be right or to hold ourselves in some special position in a relationship to this universe and to this society. The sense of oneself, the ego, and the attachment to that, of course, is destructive of this love and this beauty. Or it precludes it. pride is, I think it's hard even to admit it sometimes. Because they can have a kind of pride thinking that you're not proud. So we can be quite convinced that we're not proud. But we can always recognize the feeling when we feel, in regards to our own self-importance and our attachment to things or to positions or to people or to ideas. Now, the way is not to destroy this, but to recognize it. And this is very important to say, end this talk with, is that the way to relate to love and beauty through freeing yourselves from that which destroys or that which prevents prevents you from experiencing these things, it is through this attachment and the force of habit. And so the aim is not to try to annihilate or destroy this, but to recognize it. Because as we awaken the mind to the habitual tendencies, not to criticize them or to make any kind of value judgment about that we shouldn't be like this or shouldn't have them, the aim is to just recognize them, to know them, to see them, and to experience the result of those attachments. Then we have the insight. We have the insight knowledge to let go of the causes. So we're not just creating a kind of viewpoint that we should get rid of pride or that we shouldn't be proud, because that's still the same problem, isn't it? We can be proud that we're so humble and that we're so willing to recognize our own pride. And this goes on and on like this. It just gets more and more confusing until you realize it's not a matter of approval or disapproval, but of recognition and of seeing the result of attachment to the conditions, to the habits. And then to trust in this, like the waking up in the kuti, in this feeling of wherever way I fall, I'm all right. There's this blessedness surrounding me, this safety net. I'm not in the jungle anymore. I'm not just an animal just trying to survive in a jungle, survival of the fittest. And around the next bush some animal is going to kill me or harm me. So it's out of the jungle, which is the symbol for the realm of fear, where there is nothing to trust, and you've just got to be always alert and ready for the next possible horrible thing that can hurt you or harm you or kill you. To this realization that's based on faith, trust, and then this willingness to relax and watch and learn. Because still the habit tendencies will arise, but we're looking at them. We're not no longer in the jungle endangered by these conditions, by these savage creatures, but we can see them in terms of they come and they go, they arise and they cease. We're no longer taking the position that we are a victim or possible object of that kind of activity, because transcendent, or it's reflecting. We're seeing it in terms of its characteristic of impermanence, And so the religious path, the religious conventions help us, if used properly, used rightly, will help us to remind us of that. So in our daily life, we find that we are surrounded by that which is blessed, that which is beautiful and good. Love is something that isn't a kind of emotion that we experience toward something, but it's a way of relating. And instead of it being something that increases our sense of separation and through our wanting to hold on and cling to the object of love, we find we are that itself. That's our nature, and therefore it's not a matter of clinging, but of trusting. So I want to offer this as your Sunday afternoon, August the 7th reflection, and take away this theme of love and beauty, and use it as a just to see what, just to remind yourself when you do get caught up into the stress, difficulties, complexities of modern life, take time to just stop and rest and have faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, or in that which is ultimately true and real, which isn't this or that thing, but which is your true nature, and which you can realize as you do relax and notice and awaken to the flow of your own conscious experience. So I think now it's time for tea, and I want to invite you all to have a cup of tea, and in about 15 minutes I will ring the bell or do something to draw your attention where we can, if you have any questions, you are invited to ask them or for discussion at that time. Yeah, that's okay. Well, if you're it would be, say, if you are obsessed by those photographs, or every time you look at them, you go into some kind of obsessive emotion. But I mean, it's not that I'm against photography. Well, I wasn't criticizing photography, but just pointing out the tendency of the modern person to want to fix everything. And of course, the modern technology is kind of accommodates that desire. They've got marvelous cameras now that can zoom in on this or that and do all kinds of things. And but I find that in the long run, it's really the memory, or one isn't so eager to remember things as appreciate the way things are. And I had this before, about three years ago, I met Father B. Griffith in Berkeley, California. And he was staying in a Korean Zen center in Berkeley. And I happened to be in that area at the time, so I went to see him. And he was laying in a kind of bed. He looked very cheerful. And he was telling me about his stroke. And he said, the previous year he'd had this stroke and that he'd lost a lot of his memory. And then he said, what a glorious thing it was. Because he said before he could remember so many things, now he'd forgotten it all and he was much happier. So, I mean, he had a way of seeing the, in right in the moment, you see, that it's all right, you know, where, say, if he resented, he'd think, oh, I'm old now and my memory's gone, and then he would feel bitter and threatened by it. Whereas I was impressed that he had the wisdom to see that it was, in a way, a kind of blessing. Because he must have, you know, a very old monk, that was very intelligent, intellectual person, and must have accumulated an enormous amount of information in his lifetime. And having that buzzing around at your head in your 85 or 90 was relief to get kind of let it go. But he would seem to be, you know, really appreciative of the present, of the present moment, and his own religious, spiritual path had brought him to that. Go ahead. I think so. I mean, like I've. It was. And it varies. I mean, it's something you can't kind of. I mean, like you can intellectually, understand it, but as an actual feeling from the heart. I think it comes through the result of meditation as you see, realize the good result of it, your love of that, of the Dhamma, and of gratitude, appreciation. And I noticed that, like some people. I mean, I've just over the years, being a monk for so long and having trained monks and seen the results, that it's also very individual. It's something you can't kind of transfer to somebody else, because I can maybe inspire somebody else, but that's not it. Inspiration kind of maybe gets them going or gets them interested. But the real thing has to come from the heart itself, and it's something that you have to realize for yourself. And some people seem to have to realize that through other people. I did have a tremendous respect and gratitude to Ajahn Chah. But I think mainly there was just a real love. I mean, from the first time I heard of Buddhism, there was a strong feeling of recognition and affinity with it that I don't think too many people have, or Western people anyway. I've never had any problems with. Like in calling myself a Buddhist or a thing, this has never been a problem for me. Even though I've tried to look at other things, because in the back in the 50s, it was difficult to find any very much on Buddhism in English. So you more or less, I'd take the subject of Eastern religions and study Vedanta and all that, and which I liked and appreciated, but it didn't have the same feeling. What it is, I it's previous life karma? I don't know. But other people can not feel anything towards Buddhism. Like trying to tell my mother about Buddhism was, you know, like trying to describe life on Mars or something. She just couldn't relate to it. It didn't inspire. Didn't have the slightest interest in words like Nibbana or Buddha or anything like that. I don't think she was. Well, that's a possibility. Because, it is, you say, I wasn't in a situation where Buddhism was much of an alternative. In Seattle, Washington in the 1950s, I was brought up in a very kind of middle class environment, was basically Christian. So it's quite, you know, it's in terms of congruity, it's incongruous to the kind of context of my life in those days.
Would you say it was really possible to become emotionally involved and attached to something which is basically a concept? In the same way with mysteries, is it really possible to love a God that they've never seen and can't establish just what that God is? Would you say it's possible or not?
Well, I think if it's merely a concept, well, then it is sentimental then. But it's usually the concept takes you to more on the intuitive level. Like I would call it Dharma, just as of giving it some name or some way of relating to it. But a Christian would say God, maybe. When it's from the heart. It's not just a sentiment, a nice idea that you like, because it's comes from here, and this is where one feels that the words are not terribly important. It's not, you know, whether you're going to argue about God or Dharma. That to me is missing the point. Because they're just words, they're sounds, but they're pointing to something, to what is ultimately real, to reality itself, and that you know on an intuitive level. And the intellectual perceptions are merely ways of helping you to remember or to let go of the attachments that block it off, that obstruct you from that realization. So I was quite quite pleased with myself. Last April, I went to this intermonastic conference in Italy, and is at the San Silvestro Benedictine Monastery near Fabriano, and it was one of these magnificent old monasteries, like in the Name of the Rose, you know, the kind of like a maze of buildings and marble hall corridors and kind of grand architecture, and then they have this meeting with maybe 100 or so. There were a few Buddhists, but most of them were Benedictines and Franciscans, and just noting how I could talk about God without feeling any and feel, you know, feel confident in knowing what I was talking about, rather than, well, I used to feel, that word used to bother me a lot, because I never liked the Christian view of God that I was brought up with. I never liked that. That just left me, you know, in a state of doubt. The kind of attitude and views of God that I was brought up with in my family, in the church. And so, because of the nature of the mind, then the word God itself would always bring back those kind of perceptions, those kind of memories, the kind of smugness and sanctimoniousness of those people, and God is a kind of this kind of father up in the sky that you've got to, is always watching you, and that kind of thing. And how you're always, whenever you do something wrong, it hurts him. You're always feeling guilty. And it's kind of a, you know, it's a child's God, a child's view of God. So God was not evolved for me other than as a child's view of God. In my mother, I mean, she believed in a child's view of God, really, in the way she talked anyway, was very much like, he loves me, or I hope he loves me, and things like this. But then through Buddhist meditation, you know, one had a kind of intuition, even then, I remember, an intuition that God wasn't that way. That wasn't really God, that child's view. And so, I remember telling my sister once that when she was disturbed by my becoming a Buddhist, and I said, well, I think I have more faith in God than you do, because I don't feel it, that I feel this is a good thing to do, and is not something that would be that God would despise. Where my sister was very upset, feeling that I was going off the track, leaving the fold, that I would end up in hell or someplace like this, and so that there was this sense of God as you know, his group and his, and you had to kind of conform and do and follow and obey, and then we all would end up in the same nice place with that God forever. And that, you know, something in me just couldn't relate to that as being real or true. But in terms of Dhamma, something in us, isn't there? There's something in each one of us. Try to recognize that in you, not the questioning mind, not the self view, not the critic, not the intellect. But there's something that is intuitive and awake, and that brings you to Amravati on Sunday afternoons, or that makes you sit on a meditation retreat for 10 days with sore knees, and that keeps you going in some way. You know, no matter how your mind might get caught in doubt and disappointment, despair around maybe your own spiritual, what you think you are as a spiritual success. Don't believe it. Don't believe that kind of, that's a conditioning of the mind, does that? But in that, it's like trusting in no thing. And it's interesting to think of, like the Roman Catholics now, there's this God as no thing. And in some of the theologians. And then this vicar that was kicked out of his parish down in Sussex recently, Anthony Freeman, poor guy. And he wasn't saying he didn't believe in God as that, but he's questioning. You know, he's questioning, he's looking, he's not just kind of snap to and, you know, say, You believe in God? Yes, sir. Sometimes you think that's what they want, don't you? Do you believe in God? Yes, sir. You click your heels. Right, that's the actual literal interpretation of the word religio, the Latin. It means like binding. So like a religion is like a bond. You're binding yourself to maybe a convention that is, it's a vehicle or a convention that takes you back or to the ultimate realization. But it's not binding yourself to a convention as a personal position, but it's, or one can see it as like a vehicle. Like they call them the yanas in Pali, the Mahayana, Hinayana, Vajrayana. And a yana is a vehicle. And Hinayana is a small one. Mahayana is a big one. But it's still, it's going to the same place. But then the ego can get confused over, well, should I be in the big one or the little one? Slave of ego. We become enslaved, don't we? Enslaved to the ego. Or pride. Pride is a kind of slavery. We become enslaved to our pride. It's a real slavery when you really look at it and see it. Where a servant is like a servant of the Buddha, servant of the Dhamma, servant of the Sangha. You think of, what a lovely thing to be able to serve something and to give service rather than seeing it as demeaning you. That, I'm not anyone's servant. The conceit of I'm not going to be a servant to anybody is another conceit.
It's also a lack of belief in oneself.
Right. Because those kind of attitudes, if I'm nobody's servant, we don't know who we are. We don't want to think of ourselves in a kind of demeaning position. We like to think of ourselves as equal, as I'm just as good as anyone else. And maybe we don't like to think I'm better than everyone else. I mean, there's a few people that like to think that, but even though, sometimes we do feel that way, generally when we speak, we would never say that I'm better than everyone else. Especially here in England. say, we're all the same. We're all, I'm just as good as anyone. And, or there's a fear that we might be inferior, that I might not be as good as. And so you can see this operating. I mean, I've noticed in my own way I tend to react to things. Sometimes there is a conceit and that kind of feeling of superiority in certain situations, and other times there's a feeling of insecurity and inferiority, and rarely is there a real feeling of equality, that you're actually emotionally feeling everybody's just the same. But I notice the emotional reactions tend to shift, and usually the tendency I notice in my own mind is to have the feeling of inferiority, insecurity, not knowing, you know, feeling ill at ease or threatened by somebody else. But these kind of emotional reactions are, you know, what I used to do is try to just suppress them. But the result wasn't. It still seemed to feed the problem. It didn't diminish it. But it was through total acceptance of those feelings, just recognizing them, not making anything around them, but just the way it is. This moment, it's this way. And then you're also, like I use the sound of silence and the breath to bring attention to that which has nothing to do with the sense of yourself, and that helps to say let go of the perceptions of yourself. It's not a repressive way. I mean, if you're doing it only to avoid or get rid of, then it doesn't work. But if it's done through mindfulness, wisdom, then it works very well. So then you're aware very much of the emptiness of the mind, the spaciousness of mind, in which you learn not to create yourself. And then the emotional reactions can be accepted and resolved in the present. More and more one feels able to do that. Well, the problem always is that we tend to it, when it's directed at somebody else and then it's returned, it's so kind of marvelous that it's hard to keep it in perspective. Where it's unrequited, then the suffering helps us to keep maybe want to put it in perspective. But where it's requited, then it's irresistible. Unless you have greater love, you see, so that like not towards another person, but maybe like towards the Dhamma. But in that relationship between two people is also there is a, you know, when it doesn't get involved in self views, then there's a purity there. You know, it's pure. But then it easily goes into demands and, I mean, the emotions tend to, immature emotions tend to easily take over. But it's highly, in the Western world, we've exalted this kind of, you know, just the legends of the romantic legends of European civilization. or you know, it makes romance into a kind of all spiritual path. Do you read Joseph Campbell's books, Creative Mythology? He kind of talks about the legends of Tristan and Isolde and Heloise and Abelard and kind of all the romantic legends. And it's interesting to see that these legends are never successful. They always end up in death, not in consummation. So the romance drops as soon as they get married and have to deal with cooking and making. But it is interesting kind of human experience. And that kind of love as a path is can be very attractive and very exalted, very much so. But in say in monasticism, it's interesting within Christian monasticism, like with nuns, they try to the brides of Jesus, and yet you talk to some Christian nuns where they really feel that, and they oftentimes they get very disappointed because maybe when they enter the convent, that's quite a strong sentiment in their mind, but the realization of that can be very disappointing because maybe emotionally they're still maybe girls looking for the romantic eye, where in the actual, let's say with meditation practice, you're freeing the emotions from the conditioned, from the immature conditioning of them, and the expectations and demands of, or the emotional static problems that a person can have. You're releasing them. You're releasing those obstructions. And the thing is that the human mind can realize a universal. And so say the human side of you is conditioned into thinking, thoughts, concepts, emotional reactions. That's the conditioning of the mind. Those are mental conditions. But underlying that, or the background, or the underlying reality, is pure and blissful, luminous mind. And so the concepts, the conventions we have are, say, like with the Four Noble Truths teaching, that is to get us to contemplate the nature of suffering so that we see the end of it in the mind and we're letting go, rather than just being caught up with reacting to suffering and of any sort. We're actually letting ourselves suffer to see its pattern, and then the cessation of it. So the realization of the cessation, or the non-attachment to the conditions, or the unconditioned, realizing the unconditioned, or the deathless. And that isn't a personal thing, and that's not a dependent on your brain or your viewpoint on things. It's It's where you realize a universal, the one, rather than being say bound into the conditioning of your mind and emotions. That's so the freedom, the liberation, salvation, all these words, enlightenment is it. It, you know, if it's real enlightenment or salvation or liberation, freedom, then it's that's where the point is and the realization. Then the sense of I am somebody who was born and I will die, that is merely conventional thinking. It's no longer we build our self-view from those perceptions. Because you find, and like I find now, just a sense of I was born and I will die, even though that's conventional language, it doesn't have the same impact it did when you actually believed in yourself as somebody, a person who was actually born and who in the future will die. Because you know that's not really how it is. That's conventional reality, and that's how people think. But that's not how it really is. That's not Dhamma.
I keep wondering the exact meaning of the word Dhamma. It's a very
good
question.
Well, it's a word that means everything and nothing. It's a marvelous word. No, the way it is, the law of nature, the laws of nature, or the natural way. But nature is another word in English that tends to we don't take to its ultimate, because we think of she's natural, meaning she's we can see it as a kind of, you know, let's be natural, a kind of just be loose or free. Or we see nature oftentimes as something external to us. That's how I was brought up, to see nature as you go out and contemplate nature, you go out and look at trees, they're natural. That's nature. But I remember feeling quite surprised when I realized my body was nature. Because the cultural conditioning was nature is out there. You go and look at it, but you're not a part of it. You're separate from it. And I thought maybe this was just my problem. But then I talked to people, and it's just a general way of perceiving. And now, of course, that people say the following generations, there's much more awareness around nature, and a feeling a part of it, and one with it. But say for my generation, and I remember feeling that very alienated and separate from it, and quite surprised to realize that this was all part of it. Well, it's Dhamma, and then the Dhamma also includes everything from the conditions, all conditions, to the unconditioned. So you have sankata, asankata, dhamma, and